You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 20th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Welcome to winter.
Yes, winter has come.
Finally.
Even to LA.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was like, the high today was like 55 degrees.
How could that be with all the
poor thing?
With all the fires and everything? That's amazing.
I mean, I would say I had to wear a coat, but I actually haven't left my house yet today.
Awesome.
So this is our last regular episode of the year. 2017
oh my
is gone
gosh,
already.
Gosh, so fast.
Ugh, oh crazy.
Perception of time, just, soon. I don't know, it compresses when you get older each year, yeah. I think.
You guys, I got a Facebook flashback. You know, they do those photos. It's like 1 year ago today, 2 years ago today, of us in the in those loungy seats seeing the last big Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Awesome. Right. Yeah.
When would that have been? Two years already?
2 years ago.
Jeez.
That was 2 years, yeah.
Oh, my
that
gosh.
That was fun. We saw
that
the Force
is so
Awakens.
Hard to believe.
Force
we did
Awakens.
See The Last Jedi, everyone but Kara saw
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'm seeing it next week, so don't
I
ruin it.
I saw it twice.
La, la, la.
Well, we
We're
won't
not
ruin
gonna
it.
Talk about it, but just wanted to mention, so Alpha Quadrant 6 has an in-depth review on our Facebook page and on the Skeptic's Guide YouTube channel. So if you want to watch an hour-long review of the movie, yeah. There it is.
That was a fun review. Yeah, you can go to facebook.com/AlphaQuadrant6.
It was passionate.
Yeah, and the next week will be our year in review show, which we will have already recorded when this goes up.
Yeah.
And we will live stream that. But if you want to watch that one, it'll obviously it's in the feed as a podcast, but it'll also be on our on the SGU Facebook page as a video if you want to watch it.
And it's live streaming, right? So that's Friday, December 20, is that right? 23rd?
Yeah, 22nd, which is 22nd. The day before this goes up. So yeah, it's too late.
8 p.m. Eastern time.
Oh, I see. That's why you didn't plug it. Smart host. He's a smart host.
Yes, I can
so
tell time.
If you also have a time machine, you can catch us live on Friday evening, the 22nd.
Apparently, I can't even give the right date. So I don't know. I didn't leave my house today.
Oh, Kara.
Yes.
What is the last what's the word of the year?
Oh, you guys, that's so sad. I kind of feel like I should have picked a better one. No, this is a good one. I like it.
I've enjoyed this series tremendously, Kara,
oh,
by
I'm
the
so
way.
Glad. Thank you. This one is accretion. Accretion is a noun, which refers to the process of building up, adding on, or growing by accumulating matter, like sediment carried by water. So in geological terms, you know, land is actually oftentimes built up in deltas and silty areas, alluvia, by methods of accretion. And also, as we often use the term on the Skeptic's Guide, it's a celestial object that's building up by the gravitational accumulation of interstellar material. We usually
accretion
hear
disc.
The word, yep, exactly, Bob, with regards to an accretion disk, which is literally that. It's a disk that surrounds a celestial object, usually a star, but not always. It could be a dead star, but typically a star. And that disk is made up of dust and particles that, through gravity and friction, get hotter and clumpier as they accumulate and move in towards the object. They give off radiation because they are so hot. And depending on how hot and how big they are, the radiation might be in different parts of the spectrum. And often the cool thing is that they eject ionized matter in the form of jets. We see that in many an artist conception. I even found out that there's a whole field dedicated to understanding the oscillations of accretion disks. Do you guys know what it's called?
The oscillation of accretion disks? No.
Mm-hmm. It's not what you would expect.
Because they like pulsate with gravity.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's called disco-seismology.
I love it.
I like that.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I want it to be called accretionology. It would have worked better for this. What's the word?
Of course.
Disco-seismology makes it sound like what happens on the dance floor.
I know,
exactly.
Right? It's so great. So, I know. It's so good. the verb form of the word accretion is obviously accrete, although weirdly, the verb form is 100 years younger than the noun. The noun came first.
Mm. And it took them 100 years to figure out to say accrete?
Yep. And of course, adjective forms, if you've heard them in text or in conversation, are accretive and accretionary. I don't want to dive too deep into the etymology, but basically, one thing that I found that's interesting, and it obviously makes sense once you think about it, is that the word accrue has similar roots, although they're actually both from original Latin forms that don't start with ACC. They start ADC. So that ad portion at the beginning means to, and then my Latin is terrible, but crescere. Ad crescere would be to grow, and that eventually kind of morphed into the word we now know as accretion. Yeah.
It, does it have a similar to what about like secretion? What's the similarity there?
Oh, that would be the grow part. Yeah.
Yeah.
The crete part. Yeah. But the ad part at the beginning, or the uck part at the beginning, is just to do something. So you see that a lot in the kind of prefixes of verbs. But yeah, definitely secretion.
And what about the Isle of Crete?
I don't think that's related.
I thought that might be
unrelated.
Unfortunately.
What about the hair growth accretion formula?
The hair growth accretion formula.
Remember that?
Got that
what
wrong.
Is that?
You know what I always thought was
accretion formula? You don't know that?
Do you guys remember that comb that you just comb your hair with, and it like colors your hair because it's in the comb?
All right, well, let's get started with the news items, guys. This one is sort of good news, but I don't know. This has to do with the FDA regulation of homeopathy. This is a story we've been following for over 2 years, 2.5 years. It'll be 3 years in April. So if you recall, April 2015, so we get coming up on 3 years ago, the FDA announced that they were reevaluating their regulation of homeopathy, and they were accepting public comment, which science-based medicine enthusiastically gave our public opinion about, about how they should regulate homeopathy. The FTC did a similar thing, and FTC already came up with their revised regulations. So now the FDA finally has come out with their new guidelines for how they are going to regulate homeopathy. So let me get you up to speed first on a little bit of the background. So homeopathy, homeopathic products, this is not the practice of homeopathy, but this is homeopathic products, right? They are actually designated as drugs according to the FDA, the Food and Drug Act of 1938. The pharmacopoeia, the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, was included as a list of drugs that are regulated by the FDA.
Just grandfathered in, just slipped in, right?
Yeah, so Royal Copeland, who was a senator from New York at the time and who was a practicing homeopath, pushed that through.
He lost my vote.
Yeah, so so since then, they essentially all homeopathic products have been, because it included the homeopathic pharmacopoeia and its supplements. So they just have to say, oh, here's a new one, you know, and it gets automatically on the list. Now, they are drugs, which means the FDA has the full authority to regulate them like any other drug. They just chose not to. And they chose not to because it was such a small market. It was teeny tiny. It was a specialty market. It was mainly these products were used by homeopathic physicians or homeopaths. And so they figured this wasn't worth their time and effort. So they just punted to the industry itself to regulate itself. But then they recognized that in the last 20 years or so, homeopathic products have grown to a $3 billion industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know what? Maybe it's no longer, you know, small enough to fly below the
radar.
You
think?
Yeah, maybe we need to rethink. And then also the other trigger for this was not just that it's in the size of the industry has grown so much, but they increasingly have had to take individual action against products marketed as homeopathic because they were poisoning kids or poisoning people. They actually contained actual ingredients. And so what they also realized is that companies were labeling products as homeopathic to make an end run around FDA regulation.
Sure.
It's a huge loophole. So they said, okay, we have to revamp what we're doing here. Now they come out with their guidelines. So again, these are all internal FDA guidelines to how they're going to behave. This is not legislation. This is not a law, a mandate or anything. This is just the FDA saying, this is what we're going to do. The new guidelines essentially have two components to them. One component is to say that they are going to start regulating homeopathic products as drugs. They're essentially putting the industry on notice that they are no longer going to just let the industry regulate themselves.
Sure.
So that sounds really good on paper. Mm-hmm. You know, that sounds reasonable. The second part of it is that they are going to prioritize products that are the most risky. They're going to take a risk risk-based approach to prioritizing which products they are going to focus their attention on. And this is their list of criteria for what they consider to be the more risky products. Products with reported safety concerns, products that contain or claim to contain actual ingredients, products for routes of administration other than oral or topical, so if it's injectable or whatever, they get more interested in that. Products intended to be used for the prevention or treatment of serious and or life-threatening diseases or conditions. So if you say this is for cancer, they're going to take more interest in it as well. Mm-hmm. Products for vulnerable populations, so children, the elderly, et cetera. And products that do not meet standards of quality, strength, or purity as required under the law. So just, you know, you're not manufacturing it well. That's their list of priority.
Not bad.
Yeah, so that all sounds reasonable. Again, this way, this could be good news. I just don't know. The question is, how are they going to enforce these new guidelines? And I sort of came up with my maximally optimistic view and my maximally pessimistic view.
Okay. Yeah.
The maximally optimistic view is that they are going to gut the homeopathic product industry, and they're just basically putting them on notice. They're going to maybe start with the riskiest products first, but by saying we're going to start regulating homeopathic products like drugs, essentially, if they actually did that, if they actually do what they say they're going to do, no homeopathic product is going to survive that.
Nope.
Now, here's some further clarification. If you look at the actual proposed guidelines, there's one paragraph that's very legalese and has a lot of wonky references to specific under Section 505A of the FD&C Act 21 USC 35, whatever. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. But what it basically says is that drugs can get on the market one of two ways. Either you get FDA approval. FDA approval requires hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, the full batch of research showing that it's safe and effective, right?
Real science, right?
Or you
black
need,
market.
Or no, or you need to be, you could be marketed as an over-the-counter drug if it is determined to be GRAS/E. That means, so that's GRAS/E. The GRAS standard is
marijuana? They're selling marijuana now?
Generally regarded as safe. And then the E is safe and effective. So generally regarded as safe and effective by a consensus of expert scientific opinion, right?
So what is that? Like a Flintstone chewable vitamin?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Or aspirin. Whatever.
Yeah. Generally regarded as safe and effective.
And effective. That's the key letter right there. Yeah. That
exactly. Because the E is critical there. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's help them define effective. Let us
they
help
say,
them.
They say in their own document that no homeopathic product is either FDA approved or generally regarded as safe and effective.
Yeah.
So nothing currently meets these guidelines.
Wow.
So will they enforce it?
Well, that's the question. The question is, so it all sounds good on paper. The question is, how are they going to enforce it? So the maximally optimistic view is this is the death knell for the homeopathic product industry. The maximally pessimistic view is that under these guidelines, they are going to send strongly worded letters warning companies when they are violating the regulations and essentially make them change their marketing so that they no longer fit into the high risk category. In other words, stop claiming it's going to cure cancer, you know?
Yeah.
But they're not going to go after the bulk of the market, which is like cold remedies, because that's like not considered a vulnerable, like cold remedies for adults, like that would be, can not fit any of the criteria for high risk. But that's also a huge part of the market of homeopathic products. So it could have a very little effect if they take that sort of, we're going to send warning letters and then nibble around the edges of the most egregious, you know, risky behavior. Or it could be, if we're going to actually make them show efficacy, you know, even at the lower standard of the generally regarded as safe and effective, there isn't a single homeopathic product that will get through that standard.
Yeah. By definition. So
they will fall like dominoes.
Yeah.
So,
I think you're being very optimistic, Steve.
As I said, that's the maximally optimistic perspective. I think the reality is going to be somewhere in between.
Sure.
And we just have to wait and see where along that spectrum from heroic to pathetic, as I characterize it, that they will fall. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We will
see.
Steve, could you stop saying guidelines? Because every time you say that, I think the code is more what you call guidelines.
It's more of a guideline.
I swear, every time you say guidelines, that's what I think. Oh, my God.
I'm trying not to be a cynic with this, but like my first comment is, yeah, welcome to the party, guys. Like, seriously, what could have possibly taken this long? What, you know, this homeopathy is like the exact reason why this organization exists. Mm-hmm. And they've done so little to it. So, you know, yeah, I want to see even an inch of going in the direction that you're saying, Steve, but I just have to wait and see because I don't have any faith.
I mean, so this is going to be at least better than it was before. Right. So I think there's no way could be worse or be no benefit whatsoever because they're saying, yep, they're actual drugs. We're going to regulate them that way. They have to meet one of these standards and we're going to go after the high risk ones first. I can't imagine how this won't be a step in the right direction.
Right. And you know, they're excreting a brick.
Yeah.
Oh, they have their top lawyers on it, I'm sure.
Now, the maximally pessimistic view is that the homeopathic industry is going to unleash their lobbyists, and then Congress is going to respond by passing new legislation protecting them from the FDA. That's the worst case scenario, that there'll be a backlash against the FDA, and then regulation will trump their guidelines.
Do we know like how big and how strong that lobby is compared to other powerful lobbies in this country?
$3 billion industry. By definition, it's powerful because it has $3 billion, right? That's the problem with all of this, is that you make money by selling snake oil, and then you use the money you make selling snake oil to get the laws passed to make it easier to sell snake oil. That has been happening for 100 years. That's what's been happening. So there is a 90-day, starting December 18th, a 90-day public comment period on their proposed guidelines. So go to the FDA website and leave your comments. Let them know that you want science-based regulations. You want the FDA to do their freaking job.
Well, you can't use that phrase, science-based.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Foreshadowing.
Use it, damn it. We want science-based regulations to protect the public from fraud, because that's what this is. And then if this does get to be to the legislative level, then we will absolutely have to mobilize at that point in time. I don't know that we will have the power to stand up to a massive industry that's going to lobby on its own behalf, but damn, we got to do everything we can. We've been working towards this for years, trying to get homeopathy against the ropes. It's the lowest hanging fruit when it comes to alternative medicine. It's the most vulnerable because it is the most obviously silly nonsense. It's witch's brew. It's magical potions. It's 100% fraud. If we can't take this out, we can't take anything out. And we are making huge progress, but we got to keep the pressure up. We cannot back off. And we have to keep our eye on the ball and anticipate what the industry is going to do to save itself. It's not going to go quietly with a whimper.
It's not. The FDA is basically holding a knife to its throat. It's going to go nuts.
Yeah. But we got to go nuts too. We have to be there and say, this is what we want. This is your job and we're going to hold you to it. And they do listen to public opinion. And believe me, the other side is very vocal. We have to be more vocal. Absolutely. So there's your call to action. Go to the FDA, make your voice heard. But this is a good thing. It could be a very good thing, but we have to see and we have to be vigilant. All right, let's move on. Bob. You and Evan are actually going to both cover this, but Bob, you're going to start. You're going to tell us about these newly released Pentagon UFO videos. UFOs are back in the news.
I know.
Are they ever out of
school? Big UFO news this week. Well, big for a phenomena that doesn't really exist. a Pentagon black budget or partially black budget program was revealed recently that has spent millions of dollars searching for anomalous aircraft. Plus, there were bonus videos from sophisticated military jets. So that's probably the coolest part of this, I think. Where do we even start with this one? Probably start with Luis Elizondo, who's primarily the reason why this is in the news. He's was a recently retired director of a Pentagon program, Department of Defense, called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. They spent about $22 million, American dollars, between 2007 and 2012, collecting and analyzing details on anomalous aerospace threats. These activities ranged from apparently not only possible extraterrestrial craft, but also advanced aircraft from non-allies and even commercial drones. So it wasn't specifically focused on extraterrestrial crafts. I hate saying UFOs because it's just a horrible initialism. So the real meat, though, are the videos that everyone's seeing and talking about. And these were apparently cleared by the government for public release. So one of them comes from 2004 and was vetted by the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. They actually, and that's why that's also when this video was in the news, because this project actually vetted this as well. So in it, you have the U.S. Navy pilot commander David Fravor. So he essentially, in 2004, he was called away from a training exercise to check out some anomalous aircraft that had been descending from 80,000 feet to 20,000 feet. And disappearing. Now, this apparently was happening for like a couple of weeks, which is kind of odd. I mean, why they waited 2 weeks before they tried to get some eyes on the scene. So, but when he arrived, Fervor said that he saw what looked like a white Tic Tac about the same size as a Hornet that he was flying, 40 feet long with no wings, just hanging close to the water. He continued, "As I get closer, as my nose is starting to pull back up, it accelerates and it's gone faster than I've ever seen anything in my life." And then it's this, some of the reports are kind of mixed up as to, you know, who, what, when, and where, but apparently another crew took some video as well when Fravor was landing on the Nimitz. Another crew left and they took some video, although some of the other videos weren't necessarily from the same time period. I don't know, it's a little confused. But in that other video, you can hear commentary such as somebody saying, "My gosh." They were clearly impressed and surprised by what they were seeing. Someone says you could see a fleet of them. The video, though, of course, never shows a fleet of anything. Mm-hmm. Someone said it's going against the wind, which is actually an important observation. If that in fact was the case, another guy says it's rotating, which is also an interesting thing to observe in that specific scenario. When Fravor got back to the Nimitz, he said he didn't discuss it much, primarily because of the ribbing that he would have gotten from people and the ribbing that he did get for being involved in such a thing. But he now says the following, though. He says that he is certain about one thing. It was a real object. It exists, and I saw it. And he also describes it as something not from the Earth. So, yeah, so there's all that. He also feels compelled to say things like, "I don't think I was a nut job as an officer in the Navy. I wasn't drunk. I don't do drugs. I got a good night's rest. It was a clear day." So I actually believe him about that specifically, about his state of mind. But that's almost irrelevant in my mind. You know, people are also fond of saying similar things like that the observer was a trained professional, you know, in an attempt to boost the credibility of the person. But it's not about training. It really isn't. You know, you can't train yourself to be immune to one of the classic ways that this thing can go wrong, such as optical illusions that are misinterpreted as UFOs. Now, if you have a human brain and a well-developed visual cortex, those types of illusions are inescapable, and that's the kind of common thing that I think needs to be ruled out, especially when people are saying things like that those things broke the laws of physics, and you're seeing that specific quote all over the place with this. You know, it's like, you know, when you hear that, that's a huge red flag that no, the laws of physics probably were not broken, and if they were, you better have some damn good proof that we never see to back that up. So, for example, here's a classic example. We've mentioned it on the show many times. Steve mentions it on his post, and it's really an important one. If you make an assumption about an object's distance, you may therefore think that it's far away and huge and moving very fast. Instead, it might just be small and moving normally at a normal velocity, but being very close and tiny. So those are the kind of things that just one little assumption about distance can completely change your perception about what you're seeing.
Yeah, we also have to mention that when you're in the sky, you don't have the usual background reference points. Mm-hmm. And so your brain has a harder time making judgments like that.
Yeah.
And it's more susceptible to optic illusions.
Yeah, like the moon illusion. Yeah.
And there's, I mean, there's, the videos were interesting in that there was a lot of information of, you know, this was a military, you know, sensor data. So there was some interesting information on the screen about what was actually happening. But the bottom line was that we're basically looking at, what's it called, Steve? The proverbial blob squatches.
Blob squatch.
These were just blobs. There was really no detail at all. I mean, most of the images were infrared. So you're not going to really see a hell of a lot of detail anyway. But a couple times they seemed to switch away to another mode. One of the modes was called TV mode, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what exactly that corresponded to, but that didn't help much either. So you're basically another blob, low in detail. You know, I don't know the details of any governmental, you know, the government analysis, but I did read a lot of people online coming up with very reasonable scenarios about what it potentially could have been, or at the very least, things that should be ruled out, like, for example, the heat signatures of other planes that were in the vicinity. Perhaps some weird optical artifacts were happening, and I think that's likely as well, or at least partially for some of the things that we were seeing. Or perhaps it was some phenomenon, some natural phenomenon that we have never seen before that's not an extraterrestrial craft, but it's natural, and we just have never come across it. That kind of stuff does happen. You know, we don't know everything. I'm not saying that that's what this was, but that's just another thing that is possible. Before the very last thing on the list, after going through all that, there's one thing at the end of that list, and that's a UFO, an extraterrestrial craft. And you gotta check all those other boxes before you get to that last one, you know, before leaping to that conclusion. And a lot of these people are leaping to that conclusion, and they're just skipping a lot of those check boxes that they shouldn't.
And Bob, the bottom line is, if you check all those boxes, there's no positive information to say that it's a spacecraft.
Right, exactly.
Then you're just making an argument. Then best you could hope to do is get to an argument from ignorance. But really, right, if you check all those boxes, what it means is we don't know.
Right. There's another box that's like it will forever be mysterious given the information we have now. That's another box that's going to have to has to be addressed.
And when you just have a blob and there's no details, then you can't leap from that to a spacecraft, right? Like, we're not looking at a spacecraft. We're looking at a blob.
People who have a disposition for believing in such things do it all the time. They always make that jump.
So Elizondo is a believer, and he, yes, you know, being in charge, mm-hmm, he was pushing for the release of the best cases,
yeah,
you know, from that program, and that's what they came up with. So that, in a way, that means they have no better evidence than what we're seeing, than the blob, than the mystery blob on that video.
Yeah, that's one way to interpret it. He was asked directly in an interview I heard him he was asked if that there was lots of other documentation of this type of thing that have not been released. And he said yes, very ominously. He's like, yes. But that meant nothing to me, because the questioner, the interviewer, should have said, are there things that are more compelling? And I think if he did have more compelling videos, he would have said that.
He would have said it, and he would have pushed to release that.
So, yeah, right. So I think you could interpret that very reasonably as, yes, we have lots of similar low-grade evidence that I've just shown you, which is blob squatch. And I just, like, I don't even want to see it anymore. Give me something good, solid, something that makes me say, holy crap.
This is an exact parallel to the evidence that the Warrens offered us when we investigated them 20 years ago.
Yeah.
They gave us their best evidence, which was absolute zero evidence, absolute crap, had nothing better to offer, and that was their best.
Yep.
Yeah, that's always, yeah, like, don't give me a ton of low grade evidence that I'm not going to be able to get through. Give me your best evidence. And I do have to say, especially with this specific phenomenon with alien, visitation, I'd be happy if it's true.
Oh my God, that would make,
I want this to be something cool. Absolutely.
I want to believe.
Yeah, but it has to be real cool, though. It can't be fake cool. It's got to be real.
Yeah, I'm not compelled by a blob on a video, but I would like to see an in-depth technical analysis of all the data, which we don't have access to.
And but, right, yeah, and we don't know. And what was shown to us is just a clip, a segment of what.
Yeah,
they showed us exactly what they wanted us to see. We don't have the whole picture, even of what the videos that they did release. Yeah.
It is complicated because there's a lot of things going on. Some people were doing their best to vet this stuff, and one guy was saying, "Well, if you notice it when the object seems to rotate, the plane was banking and the camera was moving at the same time. And when that happens, it seems to rotate. So maybe it is some weird optical thing. Somebody else said that there's this known error with the type of gimbals that are used on planes like that. And if you're in certain scenarios, you could have this weird artifact that happens. And I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying these are options that need to be ruled out.
Yeah. I would put my looking at these two videos, I would put my money on an artifact, to be honest with you. But whatever the evidence shows, I would need a much more detailed technical analysis to find it even interesting. And then even then, at best, we would say we don't know what it is because it's a blob.
Do you guys know where most of the $22 million went for the research project?
No, where'd it go?
Where?
Bigelow Aerospace.
His buddy. His
Robert,
buddy.
Oh, God. Robert Bigelow. If you've known him, he is certainly an ET enthusiast, has said on interviews he definitely believes that alien life forms have visited the Earth and there are extraterrestrial spacecraft. And he has also famously had a former organization known as the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, which was founded in 1995, which was infamous for having purchased a supposedly haunted ranch in Utah, in which some of the people there described a hyperdimensional portal area, something like a Stargate, in which these paranormal shape-shifting creatures known as skinwalkers would emerge.
What?
What?
So, yes. So that's where your hard-earned text.
Elizondo addressed that his buddy, a lot of this money went to his buddy Bigelow. Evan, was it? He did say that he took steps to try to make sure that this wasn't seen as just some sweetheart deal for his buddy, and he said that they did put a lot of this out to bid, and that he legitimately won these bids. Whatever, maybe, who knows. But yeah, some of it is kind of sketchy with some of the people that have been involved. And to me, it also boils down to this. At one point, I think it was Elizondo who said, he's like, well, look at the videos. He specifically said, I find them compelling. And that's the difference between a skeptic, a real skeptic, and somebody who's not a critical thinker or skeptical at all. Because right, they find stuff like this compelling, but scientifically, they are not compelling. And that is the bottom line distinction between people that are really swayed by this and people like us that look at it scientifically and say, no, this is not compelling evidence. It's not good evidence at all.
History is not in his favor. It's in our favor. All right, Jay, how does the flu kill you?
It's pretty nasty.
Painfully.
Yeah. And shockingly, it could happen very quickly. So about 36,000 people on average, of course, these numbers can vary greatly depending on the year, but on average, about 36,000 people in the United States die per year from the flu.
36,000?
Yep.
In the United States.
That's like traffic deaths. Wow.
Yeah, globally, the numbers are up to 646,000. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people.
And that's with modern treatment.
Yeah. Well, without a doubt, you can't say that all those people are getting vaccinated. But the World Health Organization, has a number spectrum here. That was the high number. So in a bad year, that's about how many people will die. And every year I like to say something about the flu around this time, just to remind people, that this isn't a cold. It's not something that you can shake off, and we absolutely have to take vaccinations very seriously. So the question Steve asked was, how does the flu kill you? So get ready, because it's not nice. So the short answer is your body is trying to get rid of the flu, or basically any foreign body. Then the processes that your body goes through to fight an infection like the flu is what typically ends up killing you. So in a way, your own body kills you. So the flu usually enters your body through your eyes, your nose, or your mouth. And this is why you're not supposed to touch your own face until you wash your hands. That's a really, really hard habit to break. I touch my face all day. It's just, I think everyone does it all day. If you work in an office like most people do, you're going to infect yourself touching surfaces, going into the public bathroom, if there's a kitchen, it's just, virus can get anywhere. And once the virus does enter one of these mucous membrane-oriented holes that you have in your head, the virus will immediately start to use your own cells in your nose or your throat to replicate itself. So your body then can detect the presence of the growing mass of virus, and your immune system kicks in, and it starts sending tons of white blood cells and antibodies and other things called inflammatory molecules to get rid of the virus, right? So all of this, that's where a lot of flu and cold symptoms come from. Your lungs and respiratory tract are probably where the real fight takes place in your body, though. So T cells find the infected tissue, right? So when I say infected tissue, it's tissue that has been inundated with the virus. And these T cells try to destroy the infected tissue, your tissue. And this usually works, right? It does. In healthy people, it's fine. But sometimes, you know, things can take a serious nosedive, and this is the part that you could die from. If the T cells destroy too much of your lung tissue, trying to get rid of or purging the infection, your lungs will start to deliver less and less oxygen to your body, right? Because it's actually stripping away the surface of your lungs that collect distribute just gases, right?
Imagine that, like pieces of your lungs being like torn apart almost.
So Jay, you're saying that your immune system is like the Vorlons.
Exactly. That's interesting.
Oh, hey.
So they call this, this happens a lot, when this gets to a serious level, they call this hypoxia, right? Your body just can't do the gas distribution that it needs to. And, you know, and then you become oxygen starved and you die, like just like that. And this has happened, what I just described. It happens in 24 hours. You're healthy, you get the virus, and 24 hours later, it can kill you. Now, I'm not trying to be alarmist here, but it does happen, guys. 600,000 plus people a year. You know, it's not like it's uncommon. I have to be honest, you know, just to keep it real, I haven't heard of anyone dying from the flu in my collection of friends and family, right? I haven't, you know, recently. But Steve, you work in a hospital, so do you have a different perspective on that?
Because it definitely happens. And obviously, it hits vulnerable populations most, usually the elderly. What you're describing is the primary mechanism. But of course, you know, when you talk about a flu-related death, there's other ways that that could happen.
He's like, Jay, yeah, you probably have a cold, and then you probably got two or three other colds. And I'm like, what? Yeah. So this is what happens. So you get the flu, right? And the flu sucks really bad. It can last weeks, and it knocks you out. And that's why you have to sleep for days, right? Because your body is in overdrive fighting, you know, this monster that's creeping around inside of you. So your immune system can get maxed out fighting the flu. And let's say on top of that, you get a cold or, hey, how about a bacterial infection, right? And this can happen. And it can happen, especially if you work in places where there's a lot of bacteria. Like a hospital is actually a horrible place to go to if you're sick, right? But a lot of times you have to go. So what they're saying is you get a bacterial infection like streptococcus or staphylococcus on top of the flu. Now you have your immune system going nuts to get rid of two different infections now. And they call this, when you get a bacterial infection on top of the flu, they'll call it bacterial pneumonia, right? Because it can really get into your tissue.
Well, it's a super infection,
yep.
Right? Because it's occurring on top of an existing infection. If it gets into your lungs, then it's a pneumonia.
Yep.
So you might have a bacterial pneumonia super infection complicating the flu. But you could also just get viral pneumonia directly if it gets down into your lungs.
But with the bacterial infection now, you can become septic from that, which means your blood gets a bacterial infection.
Yeah.
Now this is the big bad. So now your blood becomes septic. And now your body is trying to fight that by having this immense inflammatory response. Because I guess, you know, there is a inflammatory response to get rid of viruses and bacteria. It's part of the mechanism. And unfortunately, inflammation can seriously damage your organs. So you can get the flu, click over to a bacterial infection, and next thing you know, you have organ damage going on because you got breached. You know, bacterial infection got all the way into your body. It's not just localized, it's everywhere.
Yeah, I've mentioned it on the show before. That's how my abuelita died. I mean, I don't know if it was precipitated by a flu, but she lived in Puerto Rico. She, you know, I don't think had access to the healthcare that we're really used to. And this was when I was a child. And yeah, she was septic when she died. Yeah. I mean, there are many other reasons that people can become septic. I'm not sure what, you know, precipitated the blood infection. But by the time you're septic, it's pretty dire. It doesn't mean you're not going to get through it. But if if somebody is in sepsis, it's serious. Yeah.
If you're septic in the ICU, it's like a 50% mortality rate.
Ooh. Yeah, it's serious.
Even in a top-notch hospital, it's just that there's only so much we can do.
You're just infusing them with antibiotics.
Oh, yeah, drip antibiotic.
Overwhelmingly.
And again, you know, and that's another scary avenue to go down because everybody knows, you know, we are antibiotic compromised right now, which is really scary. So just as a quick tip, if you get the flu or you get even a serious cold, don't go to work. Don't go to work. You're infecting the people at work. You're opening.
Yeah, don't
your,
be a hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are right? people that all you're going to do is be a villain after that.
Well, uh-huh. but it's also bad for you too, because you are compromised at that point. You have a weakened immune system. Your body is really tired. You need to rest. You need to take it easy. You're not doing anybody any favors going in and pretending like you're muscling through it. It's just dumb. And we all right. we have to change the culture. And I'll tell you, I don't know about globally, but in the United States, it's like, you know, employers don't like you to stay out when you're sick. You know, like I shouldn't say, you know, everyone, but a lot of people that I know, it's all basically the same story. Like, you got to rough it out as best that you can, you know, but do yourself a favor and take the time off.
All right, let's move on. Kara, this is, a layered item. Yeah, there's a lot of different angles we could talk about, but we have to talk about this because it's been so many people emailed us and there's so much talk about this apparent CDC, you know, Center for Disease Control, ban, it's not really a ban, but ban on certain words and phrases. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so Steve, you don't need me to tell you that you wrote about this week, so I do recommend that everybody go to the Neurological blog to read Steve's take. I looked into it both based on your take, based on the original Washington Post article, which is where all of this conversation first started on December 15th, written by Lena Sun and Juliet Alperin, I think that's how you pronounce that. And then there was actually some good commentary on it in Scientific American that I wanted to reference. So we'll start with the Washington Post article, which is that an unnamed source, a policy analyst within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, were at a meeting the Thursday last with senior CDC officials. And it was a meeting with a lot of budget people. And this unnamed source, who, you know, was not permitted to speak publicly about this and asked for anonymity, said that there were words during the meeting that were pointed to as being forbidden. Those words are vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based. They also mentioned that and it. No, I'm kidding. They also mentioned that in certain instances, alternatives were given. Specifically, instead of saying science-based or evidence-based, they recommended, quote, CDC bases its recommendations on science in consideration with community standards and wishes. Of course, this is all coming from the mouth of an unnamed policy analyst within this meeting. Now, when the media heard this, and I think you'll notice if you look at the Washington Post article, and I'm just going to do a control F here, that the word ban is not actually used. Oh, they did say banned words once. Crap. Okay. Well, it's not in the headline of this article, but you're right. They do use – you're right. I don't know who I'm talking to when I say that. They do use the word ban as a euphemism, although the article starts by referring to these as forbidden words. All of the – not all, but many of the sources that picked up and ran with this did call this a ban. We got a lot of emails about the word ban.
I think it was really unfortunate. I think taboo is probably a better term.
Yeah.
They weren't forbidden. Yeah. They were not banned. It was just suggested that, hey, if you want your budget approved, you might not want to use these words or phrases.
It's like a threat. It's a threat.
Well, we don't know. That's the thing. We don't know because we don't have a transcript. We don't know if it was
suggestion. If we had something in writing.
Yeah, we don't know if anybody said point blank, guys, it's a good idea not to use these words because we need to get our budget pushed through and we know we're going to be up against some difficulty. We don't know if the person in the room said, I highly recommend you don't use these words. Don't ask questions why. We don't know if the person in the room was like, do whatever you want. But if you notice, we're consistently getting our stuff shut down. So maybe we play by the rules that we think will work within this administration. We have no idea, but we did see a similar example of this. I think I covered it several weeks ago, maybe a few months ago on the show, when somebody was putting together their budget approval about climate change and they decided to change some of the language. They were actually asked very point blank to change some of the language in an effort to get it through. So in a way, it seems like, yes, this is individuals who are obviously pro-science. They work for the freaking CDC. They do science every day. This is an epidemiological institution that does a lot more than just epidemiology. They do evidence-based work. They do science-based work on diverse populations who are vulnerable, who may be transgender. They also talk about Zika virus and other examples in which the word fetus is necessary. But obviously, I think what this really is about not banning anything, but about censorship. And I think that that's the word that's not being used enough in the media. To call something censorship does not require a legal aspect to it. Censorship can happen via threat. Censorship can happen via suggestion. To censor is just to put somebody or a group of people in a position where if they are to speak or write or reference something, they will have negative ramifications and that could silence them. And I think that's where we're really concerned here. I mean, Steve, you wrote in your piece about the previous problem with the CDC, the 1997 Congress, who said that the CDC should not do research that advocates or promotes gun control. And because they didn't want the headache, they just stopped researching gun violence.
Yeah, they did successfully shut down gun research at the CDC. And so this is this, I think, you know, my interpretation of what's been said and what hasn't been said is that there's just a chilling effect at the CDC. And clearly they thought internally that they're going to self-censor in order to avoid headaches. So I think they've been just properly cowed at the CDC. But unfortunately, it created a situation where everyone has plausible deniability, right? And then so the CDC director said, there's no banned words. We can say whatever we want. It's like, well, okay, that's not really what's being alleged. The director of the HHS said that the discussion, an internal discussion about budgetary strategies being mischaracterized. So neither the CDC director or the HHS director, that's Health and Human Services under which the CDC operates, neither of them denied the reports. They just denied the characterization of it as a ban. And of that course. Tells me that it's true, because otherwise they would have said, this is completely not true, that nothing like this happened. Yeah. This is made up. They didn't say that. They said, oh, it's not quite what you think. It's being mischaracterized. There is no ban. So that means this did happen.
Yeah, and also it wasn't just that one policy analyst. The Washington Post was able to corroborate it. And, you know, journalists require multiple – I mean, good journalists want multiple sources before they go to publish. And I think that they felt that they did their due diligence and got multiple sources to corroborate.
They had multiple sources.
Yeah, and so obviously something happened. We don't know point blank exactly the wording, but we do know the gist. And that's what's important in this conversation. I thought it was really interesting that there's a piece in Scientific American. It was published on just yesterday about this whole issue, in which a Scientific American reporter actually interviewed a cognitive scientist from UC San Diego. And this cognitive scientist, her research is basically on how language changes our perceptions. And so a lot of the questions in this interview are like, you know, what happens when we use certain words versus when we don't use other words? She does a great example of saying, you know, if I tell you a hamburger is 80% lean, you're going to think of it as healthier than if I say it's 20% fat.
Yeah, it's the framing issue. Yeah.
And this is a not a necessary outcome of this, but a possible outcome of this, which is very worrisome. Like that, basically, this whole article is just here to kind of provide some evidence as to why words really do matter, especially in conversation.
Because like the CDC health surveys, they've stopped asking about gender identity and things and questions like that. These questions are already being censored out of the data that they are collecting. So this is not happening in a vacuum. And it's just unfortunate that the reporting got so caught up on the ban word.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
It really just it enabled the other side just to say fake news, it's been debunked, and then criticize us for even talking about it as if we're spreading fake news. Like, no.
Yeah, and then just change the subject and move
more
on.
More nuance here. Okay, let's move on. Jay, it's who's that noisy time?
Okay, last week I played this noisy. Lots of guesses.
Very very intriguing noise.
Bad guesses, though. Lots of bad ones.
any correct ones?
Well, you know what's funny? There's a line where I don't know if people are kidding.
Tuh.
You know, if you think about it, I just don't know. So, I mean, you know, either way, this is all for fun. But one guy wrote in, this is Joe Vander Eden, and he said, he said it's the Eastern Whipbird. And then he said, slow the sound down. It sounds like a rapid crescendo. First time I've guessed in 9 years, I've been listening. Cheers, man. I think this was a legit guess. I'm not laughing at you.
yeah, thanks, Jay.
But I thought the whip bird was a funny whip bird.
I like that.
Yeah maybe
like
it could have been.
Jay,
I mean, it sounds like something you would do. Slow it down, speed it up, do something.
And Kay Chalice said, hi to Who's That Noisy. Love the show. This week's Noisy sounds like a Tesla Clio starting up and a spark firing off of it as it discharges.
That's what I was thinking.
However, the winner for this week, Justice Smith, said to Who's That Noisy, I don't know what I'm doing. Noisy. Probably too late, but I've been pondering the familiar sounding Noisy all day, and then it struck me. Is it the sound of the recently observed neutron star collision?
The kilonova?
The gravitational waves produced by that event, as recorded by LIGO, made a very similar sound. Or maybe that it whip. Was a bird. I don't know. Everyone like backs up with the bird. So yeah, so last week's Noisy, this was sent in by a listener named Steve Harris, who is a friend of the show. It's a huge blast of energy that's generated. These two neutron stars collided with each other. The energy that was generated is in the form of gravitational waves, and that sends a ripple through space-time, right? So it's very science fiction-y, but it actually happens. Gravitational waves do not make any sounds, but the scientists can convert the frequencies into audio files that we could hear, and that's why we could hear this Noisy. Now, these two neutron stars collided 130 million years ago. This is like dinosaur era. Gravitational waves that the collision created just recently reached the Earth, so it took 130 million years for it to get here, which is very far away. And another interesting thing is activity like this is where gold and platinum come from.
Yeah, Bob talked about that.
Yeah.
I have a new Noisy.
Let's hear it.
Check this one out. Okay.
That's it?
That's it. Could be funny. Could be serious. Could be, you know, high up. Could be very low.
Can I ask you, is that an animal?
I'm not telling you anything. This is the last Noisy of the year. There are no
hints.
That
means it's an animal.
There are no hints. There's no help.
Vegetable.
All right, that Noisy was sent in by a listener named John. Thank you very much. Guys, have a great year. I had a wonderful year with Who's That Noisy. Thank you so much. I got a ton of good Noisies queued up for next year, but man, send me in those Noisies. I need them because I just keep picking the best one. Email me with answers and Noisies at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, everyone, we have a great interview coming up with Joe Nickel. Now, I have a 25-minute abridged version of the interview in the show, but if you are a premium member of the SGU, you can listen to a full 50-minute version of the interview, which will be uploaded at the same time as premium content. So some people like to skip the shortened version, just listen to the longer version. So,
and Joe is a true Renaissance man.
Yeah, as you say during the interview. And so go ahead 25 minutes if you want to do that, if you want to skip this so that you can listen to the full version. Otherwise, let's listen to Joe Nickel. All right, well, we're sitting here with Joe Nickel at SciCon 2017. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you.
Yeah, it's been a little bit.
Of course, as you get my age, it's good to be anywhere with anyone. So
for almost 50 years, you've been a paranormal investigator. Has anyone else you know of that's basically made a career out of doing that full time?
Not really. Yeah. There are people who want to be sort of known for doing that, and some of them repeat my work and don't give me credit. But no, I think as far as I know, I'm the only one who actually has a full time salaried position, science-based, this is, note all the adjectives, paranormal investigator.
Yeah.
That is, there are a lot of people who are doctors, psychologists, college professors, physicists, whatever, that are great investigators, but they have a day job. Mm-hmm. And I'm the only one that I know who full-time has a day job doing it. But please don't tell the people I work with that I, you know, have a good time or anything like that, because I would be an into it.
And there's a lot of gullible investigators out there, so you had to qualify that as science-based.
Well, exactly. If you don't say science-based, because there probably are some ghost hunter types who doing it more or less full-time or whatever, but bless them, they don't know what they're doing. And quite often, the ghost hunter types, I mean, they're photographing orbs or some other ghostly effect or recording electromagnetic fields or something.
Or they're saying, did you hear that? Yeah. Did you hear that?
Right, right. That's their refrain. Did you hear that? And in fact, they're often, I make this argument, detecting themselves.
Yes.
Because what do you get when you go through an old place and you stir up the dust? Well, of course you will get orbs then, because orbs are particles of dust reflecting, bouncing back the flash. Or they get EMF readings. Mm-hmm. Well, they may be recording some of their own electronic equipment, mm-hmm. for heaven's sake. It's really a fool's errand, and they don't know what they're doing. And they even admit it sometimes by saying, I remember one guy saying, we use a Geiger counter or anything that could give us some data.
Yeah.
I think, oh, just anything? Like a dowsing rod? Sure. Psychic? Sure. Yeah. Flip a coin? Sure. Data. No, this is a fool's errand, because first of all, these methods are not shown to actually detect ghosts. So you could collect a lot of it, but so what?
Right.
And then they don't know what it's actually measuring, and they have no idea what to do with this quote unquote data.
Yeah. So I know we were looking at this. They buy like an EMF meter off the shelf or whatever. And then you ask them, so what frequency do ghosts emit EMF in electromagnetic frequency? Well, whatever the detector is set to, whatever range my detector is set to, that's what the frequency is.
And they have no idea that microwave towers or faulty wiring or their own equipment could be.
Iron will do it.
It's electromagnetic fields are ubiquitous, but they just have no idea.
And they're everywhere.
And I'm pretty sure when I've gone with some of these groups, they're detecting my magnetic personality, right. But that's another complicated story.
So, Joe, what's happening, though, they must know that there is information out there explaining how not only these devices are supposed to be used, what they're actually supposed to be detecting, and people such as yourself who have shown you how to go about a real scientific investigation. Yet, are they just conveniently ignoring that because they've already come up with conclusions in their head and they're just retrofitting everything backwards?
It's very hard for people who, once they have completely committed to an idea, to be reasoned out of it. If they didn't use reason to get belief, they're not going to be reasoned out of it. And sometimes I suspect that some of the more cynical Bigfoot hunters and the like don't believe. They know better. They're just out for the hustle. They collect money for Bigfoot tours. People collect funds for, you know, ghost walks, ghost tours they give, or haunted house tours. And that it's not in their interest to believe any kind of skepticism. So what some of them seem to do is, they'll talk about orbs unless and until you point out what really causes orbs. And then they'll say, well, yes, there is some indication of that. That's true. But, you know, there are different kinds of orbs. And we can tell the difference sometimes between the type of orb you're talking about and the other type. And it's just they're off in Never Never Land.
They rationalize it all.
Yeah. And whether we have no real good test as to whether people are sincere or not. Mm-hmm. We don't always know.
Joe, have you ever talked to ghost hunter? And when I say ghost hunter, there's a few different kinds, but the kind that actually believes that ghosts exist and that they're, you know, these, you know, varying degrees of people thinking that they're doing good work or whatever. But did you ever educate someone that's in that classification out of being a ghost hunter?
Not as directly, maybe, as you suggest, but I remember I was checking into a hotel, motel, in the edge of Syracuse, and I was speaking at a community college. And the guy at the hotel desk said, are you really Joe Nickel? When I gave him my name. And I said, I think so. I think I can prove it. And I gave him a wooden nickel. And he said, you know, I was a ghost hunter and interested in all that stuff until I read your book.
Wow. That's
and I thought, wow, that's really good.
Yeah.
I gave my talk. A woman came up and she said, well, I was one of those silly ghost hunters until I heard you talk and read some of your stuff. And I quit.
Yeah.
And that was twice in one night. I never got over that. It was like, wow.
What are the odds?
And I've had people say similar things about, you know, they say, they read my book Looking for a Miracle, and it just changed them as far as, you know, they would realize that all the sort of magic trick stuff, the weeping statues, the shrouds of Tura and the, all of that stuff is just without merit.
Yeah.
And many of them went all the way over to an atheist view, though I like to, you know, always insist that people, it's good to become an atheist, but that's only part of the way.
Yeah.
And the rest of the way is to become a secular humanist, which is an atheist with a heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can become a whole person and you can actually have moral values.
Of course.
You don't need a God to tell you not to kill, to be nice to people, treat people with respect. You don't. And I recommend secular humanism. I'm proud to be a secular humanist.
Yeah.
But when people call me an atheist, I say, well, that's true. I don't deny that, but that's only part of the story. And then it gives me an opportunity to say secular humanist. And a lot of people will bite, you see, instead of being angry at you. Oh, you're an atheist. You should be stoned to death.
Yeah.
They'll say, what is that? And I use my little clever, it's an atheist with a heart.
Yeah.
And what's that mean? And you know,
It's like you're starting a conversation from a different perspective. And it's more digestible than atheist because we all know, you know, the term atheist is dirty. It's bad.
Now, the term skeptic also carries some baggage with it. You must have experienced that over the years.
It does. And we have to sometimes distinguish, as we all know, with climate change, you know, what does it mean? You can say you're a skeptic about climate change. Well, no, you're really a denier. We've had to make that distinction because you can be skeptical of anything, absolutely anything. The earth being round, you can be skeptical of that and believe in a flat earth. And people do. So I think skeptic is a good word, but I want it, you know, I want us to know what we're talking about. And I say that we are, a skeptic is one who's skeptical of that to which skepticism is due, which sounds a little circular, but it's a way of saying it, that if something it sounds too good to be true, something is very far-fetched on the basis of the pretty established scientific knowledge, Bigfoot being an example, no fossil record, no evidence, not a live specimen, nothing.
Yep.
So it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it means it's very, 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 edit the tape so there's 50 more varies in there. Unlikely. And so we're skeptical of that for those reasons. It doesn't mean we deny it, just it's a measure of how doubtful we are. And so I think skeptic is a good word. It means based on evidence, we question something, based on evidence. Whereas a denier is not really got a body of real good knowledge, I don't think. And that, maybe that if that's a helpful distinction.
Well, I think, you know, adding in based on high quality or reliable or repeatable evidence needs to be put in there because the deniers have evidence. Flat earthers have evidence.
So, you know, skepticism is a process, right? We care about going through a valid scientific logical process, whereas denial, the conclusion comes first, right? And then they just are denying the science that's inconvenient for the conclusion, which is really what they're on about. Whereas, you know, we would change our minds based upon the evidence.
Right.
They're immune to evidence. So it's a form of pseudoscience where they sort of flip the narrative to they're not trying to promote a positive claim. They're trying to deny a claim that's established within science.
It turns out that we have to be careful because skeptics have also come across a lot of times not as thoughtful science-based skeptics, but as naysaying, knee-jerk, denying debunkers.
Yeah. Cynics, yeah.
All those flying saucers, that's all a bunch of hooey and those people were probably drunk and these people were probably hoaxing when they often didn't know a thing about the particular case in question. Whereas I would, as you know, trouble to go to Flatwoods, West Virginia and talk to old folks and check out what could have been the UFO and there was a meteor seen over three states. Oh, and this creature with a heart-shaped face and terrible claws. Well, that's our old friend, the barn owl. So, yes, a frightening case, but we need to know whereof we speak and to be able to say to people, here's why I doubt that case.
Right, exactly.
It's based on it's an evidence-based doubt.
you need to go through the process. You can't just jump to a skeptical conclusion because you think it's skeptical.
Exactly. It's process, as you've pointed out. I always, when I have time, I try to elaborate on the evidence and show where I got to, you know.
So getting back to your job as an investigator, because I do think that that is something that we need within the skeptical movement. The idea
to still
we need boots on the ground. And I think one of the things I get worried about a little bit is that with the internet and everything, it's just so easy to do your internet research and to think that that's enough. And maybe for some questions it is, if the information you need is all there. But, you know, when there isn't, you know, there's just no substitute for doing physical investigation. And we've chatted about this before, including just recently, about the fact that when you physically go into a place, you learn things that you just will not learn on the internet. You were telling us a story about when you went to the Sniper's Nest of Oswald. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a revelation for me because I'd certainly been very skeptical about the conspiracy theories, and I'd read a lot. Maybe I hadn't yet read Gerald Posner's excellent book, but maybe I'd read Vincent Bugliosi's very good book, and was beginning to see, you know, how to think about these far flung conspiracies. And I looked out the window from the sixth floor, and it was a revelation to me because I'd heard all about how it would have taken some expert marksman that's unimaginable and so forth. And you see that what basically was happening is the motorcade was going away from them. Mm-hmm. They rounded a curve and went and was going away from the rifleman. And all you had to do was just, as you fired your shots, was just gently lift your barrel a little bit to keep in, you know.
On target, yeah.
On target. Whereas if you had someone going at right angles to you, that's a very difficult shot because then it's not some gentle movement. It's you may have to move in a sweeping
and lead him a little bit
way, and then you've got to lead a little, shoot a little ahead, and so forth. And it's a lot more complicated. I don't think it was a very complicated shot, and there is some question over which of the three shots was the missed shot. But people often don't even take that into consideration that Oswald missed one shot.
One of the three shots missed.
So. If you look at the best evidence, pretty clear that Oswald Auben by himself was at the Sniper's Nest, left his handprints on the boxes and on the gun, and we have pictures of him with. I mean, it had masses of corroborative evidence,
like the shroud, right? But then
just like the shroud,
the conspiracy theorists pick at each one with a special invented excuse or explanation. But
exactly,
it all hangs together, really.
And I find this
story
with the things I've worked on over and over. I look for corroborative evidence.
Yeah.
I want to be able to explain things like the Flatwoods Monster. Why do I think that's a barn owl? Because I'm adding up the heart-shaped face, the fact that it could glide, that it made a high-pitched hissing sound, that Mrs. May said it had terrible claws. And the only thing I have to have a special argument for is that, of course, the barn owl is not, you know, 8 feet tall, but it would be perched on a branch. Mm-hmm. And that gives you the height. And corroborating that, all the witnesses were vague about the bottom of the creature.
Yeah.
Sure.
They described it sort of waist up.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the bottom was sort of maybe blur, green. Yeah. They weren't sure. Well, they were just seeing foliage underneath. Yeah. This whole thing happened in a matter of moments and it came right at them. And then I go even further, more than most skeptics probably would care about, but I wonder about things like, well, why did the barn owl stand its ground? Why didn't it just, when these people were coming up with flashlights and a dog and stuff, why didn't it just fly off? Mm-hmm. What was this about? And then I thought, it was a she and she's brooding young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she just went right over the hissing. And you have to hear a barn owl do this.
Yep.
It's the scariest damn thing. I had no idea that they made a noise like this. It's a scary noise with a claws out. And that's when I was pretty sure that of all the creatures on this planet, the one that best fit all of those with a very little rationalization on my part and not really a stretch in any point.
Not a stretch at all,
This is likely what they saw. And I often argue then for what I call the preferred hypothesis. Mm-hmm. That is the hypothesis that explains the most with the fewest assumptions.
Right. Occam's razor.
Occam's razor, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I say to other people, look, you can't just not like my hypothesis. You can say, oh, I don't think that's, you know. No, no. If you want to remove it from its preferred perch, you must do one of two things. You must show it has an absolutely unquestionable fatal flaw. If it does, I'm a dead man. I'm gone. But if it's just you have an opinion about something, well, that's not enough.
Yep.
And the other factor is you can remove mine by having a demonstrably better one, has fewer assumptions. Say I was describing some type of owl that didn't live in the area, and I was having to propose that, they could fly out of their area and
it's
possible that they could have come that far and so forth. Okay, but you come along and you know of a variety of owl that is better than mine, bigger owl, and lives right there. Well, see then, and in fact, I did that to myself when with Mothman, I first thought it was a barn owl, rushed into print. Oh, this was a bad mistake on my part. And then I learned about the red crimson eyeshine, and I started looking into that. I said, whoops. So I went down there and spent time, and I found that right in that area were barred owls. They were bigger, and they had this crimson eyeshine that was described as like bicycle reflectors. Mm-hmm. And I just shifted owls. And one of my friends said, oh, big deal. You weren't very wrong. And I said, well, okay, but I was wrong. I was wrong. Yeah. And I need to correct that. I read a new article.
And how often do the other side of these arguments do that, correct themselves?
Not so often.
It doesn't happen.
I saw one ghost hunter who had written quite a glorious thing about the Myrtle's plantation and the slave Chloe who had poisoned the plantation children because of evil things the master was doing to her and stuff and all this. And I went there, of course, Discovery Channel let me have got to spend the entire night alone in the Big Myrtle's plantation.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was great. And I stayed up quite a while with, you know, infrared image device and so forth, looking for evidence and prowling around, seeing if I could cause a door to open. I could.
Yep.
I could duplicate mysterious things. But I went to the Historical Society and found out that Chloe was fictitious. None of that ever happened. No such slave, no record. They had records of slaves. She was not a slave. It was a made-up name. And more than that, the family members who died were not poisoned. They died in a cholera epidemic. And it just blew that out of the water. And one ghost hunter, without citing me, but he did silently, I can show you the two versions, and he did correct that part of that story. I don't know if it was from me. I think it was.
Yeah.
I think it was. But good for him that he did that.
Good.
You know. But we all should do that. We all should constantly be tweaking. You know, I've had a lot of research I've done on orbs. I've made orbs. I now, whenever I go to a famous haunted place like Alcatraz, I make orbs. I recently was in an insane asylum in West Virginia, great historic age, dates back to the Civil War, huge place. And I stepped back, lagged back from the ghost tour, the tour group, and ducked into one of the old crumbling rooms and made orbs. And I made orbs at the Conjuring House from the movie The Conjuring, the Warrens place, and made orbs in the barn where the witch, had supposedly hanged herself. Well, none of that happened. And I show that it's easy to make orbs.
Yeah.
And if you make them under controlled conditions, you pretty well know what you're speaking of.
You can mass produce
them. I only recently had an opportunity for an upcoming TV show, to show that you can also make orbs on video.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I hadn't really known that you think, well, the flash bounces back and you make still photos, but you don't have a flash when you're shooting video. Well, but you can have, and Tom Flynn and I made a lot of control conditions, and we could show you, we could see a particular particle of dust and watch it on the camera and see that is the orb in the picture. Mm-hmm. But the camera's recording it as it comes close out of focus, and it makes it perfectly round, even though the piece of lint might not be round at all, really.
Yeah, and an orb, just for our listeners, just a sphere of light on a photo that gullible ghost hunters say is a ghost. It's a ghost
right.
orb.
They get orbs, they say. And that always amused me. And there's a serious point here. If you look at the history of ghost photography, the earliest photographs, daguerreotypes, ambrotypes, and so forth, had no ghosts in them. Only when glass tintypes, for example, there are no ghost tintypes that I've ever found. Unless somebody was making a theatrical ghost picture of Hamlet's ghost or something of a play or something like that, but no real ghost photos. And only when glass plate negatives made possible double exposures, and then the ghosts look like people and they're transparent and they look like we all came to think ghosts look like. But if you go on through and watch how the cameras develop, when these little pocket cameras come in, you start getting a couple of things. One are these orbs. Mm-hmm. We didn't have those before. Mm-hmm. The little built-in flash camera is just ideal for producing orbs. And also, Bob was kind enough, I think, to credit me with the camera strap effect.
Yeah. Camera strap.
I was certainly one of the first people who caught on to that. And that was thought of as ectoplasmic strands something.
Joe, I remember when we talked about you and camera straps, and then we did it. We want to see it for ourselves, and we tried to do it. You start to holy Christ, I got them, they're working.
Yes, and the more of that kind of this is in a phrase that I like to use a lot is hands-on skepticism. In other words, go there. The only way I solved, and I've talked about this in probably every show of yours, but the only way I solved the footsteps on the stairs at McKenzie House was I went there and I found, which I wouldn't have done by sitting in my armchair at home, I found that there was a staircase in the building next door and a late night cleanup crew, and I was able to talk to people and verify that whole thing. And it was just a lesson to me, like, what if I hadn't come here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. And I knew that was about 1972. And that's when I really knew, wow, this is what you have to try to whenever you can. Yep. Now, a cold case is 50 years old and the house is torn down.
Nothing you can do.
That's not going to help you. But again, you might go to the Historical Society and you might look at microfilm of old accounts of the story and show how the earliest version was not like what was told later, and that might be very useful, you know. And you might want to do an experiment. In other words, the camera strap, the orbs, those kind of things, they're eminently experimentable with.
So
I roll up my shirt sleeves and make Shrouds of Turin the subject of my upcoming talk.
Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
I'm grateful to be talking with you.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Even though this is the last science or fiction of the year, just three regular news items, nothing special about this one. This is your last opportunity, guys, though, to get your score up before we do the reveal next week. Are you ready?
Yes, my liege. Mm.
Okay, here we go.
Yes. Yes, Supreme Commander.
Item number one. New research on medieval cathedral glass finds that it flows 16 orders of magnitude faster than previously estimated. Item number two. New flu vaccine practice guidelines increase precautions for patients with egg allergies due to an increase in reported allergic reactions. And item number three, researchers have successfully harnessed sperm to deliver chemotherapy directly to cervical cancer cells. Evan, go first.
This medieval cathedral glass, it flows 16 orders of magnitude faster than previously estimated. That's a lot of zeros after that one, right?
Yeah, 16 of them.
So that would be something. I mean, what? Oops, got that wrong. Forgot to carry the billion or whatever. it seems a little strange.
That's a gajillion, by the way, yeah. I think.
But okay, I mean, sure. I mean, how much science is going on in the study of the viscosity of cathedral glass? So maybe they did some research years ago, put it aside, came back a generation later and realized, oh man, we were way off. So I think that one could be right. Then the second one about the flu vaccine, the guidelines increase precautions for patients with egg allergies due to an increase in reported allergic reactions. Well, I tend to think this one would also be science. I bet reporting of allergies is generally on the increase. I don't see why this would be any different. You know, the peanut butter example, I think, is kind of obvious. Nobody knew it when I was a kid. No one knew about it. But, you know, now it's obvious. It's everywhere and well recognized. So other things must have also gone along, certainly, that trajectory. And I think this one could also be the science. The last one, they harness sperm to deliver chemotherapy directly to cervical cancer cells directly. Maybe that's the problem with this one. Maybe it's indirect or something else happens along the way. I think all three of these are science. I don't know which one's the fiction. Gee whiz. Egg allergies. Although there are an increase in reported allergic reactions, I don't think... I think something's up here. Something's wrong with this news item. I can't quite put my finger right on it. I think the other two are going to turn out to be science, though. So I'm just going to have to say the egg allergies one is the fiction. Sorry.
Okay, Kara.
It's very hard for me to believe the first one. Very hard. 16 orders of unless it's like so infinitesimally small, 16 orders of magnitude is like... I don't know. Like, how small would it have to be? I know. It's like at a certain point, if they were off that much, then wouldn't all of this glass just be liquid already? I don't know. I'm very confused. Flu vaccine practice guidelines increase precautions for patients with egg allergies due to an increase in reported. This one seems like fiction to me, too, because I thought that there wasn't albumin in like newer vaccine. Maybe there's still albumin in flu vaccines, but there's like the nasal spray ones. There's all the different kinds. I don't know. Researchers have successfully harnessed sperm to deliver chemotherapy directly to cervical cancer cells. Hilarious. I don't know why that's hilarious, but yeah, I kind of want that one to be true.
It's the delivery mechanism that you're curious about.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Is it like in a turkey baster? I think I'm going to go with Evan, but I think it's not because of some feeling, Evan. Mm. I think it's because it's that there's less albumin, and so people need to people are having less reactions. I don't know why they would change guidelines around that, but I think that's probably what's happening.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so they wrote about the medieval cathedral glass, and it's flowing 16 orders of magnitude faster than previously estimated. That's 16 times. That's a gigantic number.
10 quadrillion.
Yeah, so my,
thanks,
my initial observation here is I have a skeptical flag going off about the idea about flowing glass. You know how they get like, look at that old west window, you know, from that western town. And why is it thicker on the bottom? And I remember reading something about saying that they put the thicker side of it on the bottom because it weighs more. You know what I mean? Like it just was a balancing thing. It didn't really have anything to do with the glass flowing. So I'm kind of calling a little bit of shenanigans on the glass flowing at all. And if it is, nope. Is it flowing enough, you know, or fast or whatever? I don't know. I just, yeah. So the whole thing to me, I do have a memory of some type of legitimate information in there. So yeah. Next one, flu vaccine practice guidelines increase in patients and eggs and juggling. Yeah, I don't agree. This doesn't bother me, especially because I'm really not happy about the first one. And then this last one here about the researchers with the harness to sperm delivery. Yeah, of course they're going to repurpose sperm. Those little guys got to work. They got to work for their money. You know, you don't want to accidentally get someone pregnant, right? I mean, maybe they're genetically modifying them to not be able to impregnate someone and are just using like the shell of the sperm and not like, you know, not delivering actually any genetic material. Sure, crazy. I don't know. I'm not feeling right about the glass flowing one. That's the fiction.
And Bob.
Yeah, this the 16 orders of magnitude. Come on, you know. Actually, they've gone back and forth so many times about glass flowing or not that I forget where the last consensus right? was.
Exactly.
I don't even remember it at this
flowing
point.
Itself.
And 16 orders of magnitude, I mean, that's a lot. That's huge. But the thing is, of course, if the original movement was sufficiently small, then even 16 orders of magnitude of next to nothing is still probably close to nothing. Good point. That can go – nothing would surprise me at this point. The sperm one, yeah, that's – they totally make sense. I mean, the sperm's got an axoneme. I mean, come on, of course. What a great way to transport stuff. But even that one can be just like – because the first two seem a little dicey, and then the third one sounds so reasonable. I could just see Steve totally – playing that, whatever, you know, you just gotta just go with, all right, I'm gonna go with Jay.
You know, going with me is going with yourself 72% of the
that's
time.
That's right. When you're playing Jay, you're playing. Never mind.
16 orders of magnitude just seems like a little bit too much. So I'll say that one is fiction as well.
Right,
Bob and Jay are with the glasses, the fiction, and Evan and Kara are with the flu vaccine is the fiction, so you all agree.
Steve, yeah. Can we say that me and Bob are against Evan and Kara tonight?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so you all agree that researchers have successfully harnessed sperm to deliver chemotherapy directly to cervical cancer cells. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Nice.
Yay.
All right. So two of you are right and two of you are wrong.
But we were all right on this
who
one.
In a moment, they did exactly that. They packed a chemotherapeutic agent, doxorubicin, into bovine sperm cells.
And then they
outfitted, this is just a proof of concept, they outfitted them with little magnetic harnesses. And then they used a magnetic field to guide the sperm to where they wanted it, to the tumor, basically. And then they released them. They released the sperm.
Release the hound.
Go, be free.
And so then they swim up to the tumor. And when they, how sperm work, when their head hits the target, they explode with enzymes, which eats its way into the cell. And so what they do that and they release the chemotherapy right into the cancer cells. And, in this study, they found that it killed 80%, more than 80% of the cancerous cells. Yeah. Yeah. I think this is all in a petri dish type of thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So not in critters.
This is so test far tube. From being a real person.
It needs to be tested in animals and then humans. Those are the next two steps.
Yeah. All right. So I didn't quite hear the answer. Do they strip out the genetic material?
They didn't say in the
Well, they probably don't have to at this stage in the process.
Yeah.
They're just trying to make sure it's
the idea is though to get the drug to the cancer cells and bypass the healthy cells. Right. Mm-hmm. And it did that with, so it was just a way of targeting the chemotherapy at the cancer cells. And this method did work to some extent. So, this has potential. It is something funny about thinking about the sperm swimming to the tumor and delivering the chemotherapy, you know.
It's like a guided bomb.
Like a little guided bomb.
It's like it's little Arnold Schwarzenegger's going, kill the tumor.
Let's move on. So Bob and Jay, you think that the first one is the fiction. New research on medieval cathedral glass finds that it flows 16 orders of magnitude faster than previously estimated. You guys think this one is the fiction. Evan and Kara think this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh, it is.
Yes!
Sorry, we did it, Kara.
Evan!
Well done.
Woohoo!
Well done.
Sorry, brothers. So, but you guys are correct in that it was so tiny to begin with that it's still tiny, even though it's 16 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, it's the only way it could be true. Right.
Now, glass is interesting because glass kind of we're not sure if it's a liquid or a solid because it basically has the properties of a liquid, but at our time scales, it behaves like a solid because it's an amorphous substance. It's sort of structured like a liquid, but it's like frozen in time in a way. And so it acts like
a solid. Is it a quantum liquid?
No, I don't think so. Okay. by doing careful measurements of medieval cathedral glass, so it's just really old, they were able to get refine their estimates of how quickly the glass flows or how viscous it is, and they found that it's actually a lot faster than what we previously thought. And Evan, I think you're the one who said maybe it was just some like one old study somewhere. And that's kind of right. They really didn't have a lot of direct measurements of this.
Mm.
But they said that even with the new estimates, it would take billions of years to cause nano-sized alterations in the shape of the glass. So it's still insignificant.
But it still technically flows.
Yeah, how's the glass thicker at the bottom if it takes billions of years for nano-sized changes?
It's not thicker at the bottom because of the flow of the glass.
It's manufacturing.
Jay is correct. When, especially they used to manufacture glass by spinning it and then to make it lay out flat, and one side would always be a little bit thicker, and they would put that side on the bottom because it's more stable to make something bottom heavy than top heavy.
Hey, Jay, you were right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agreed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's fundamental.
So, but I was trying to trick you up because, yeah, it is flowing 16 orders of magnitude faster, but it's still freaking slow.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I lost for you, Jay. I did it for you, bud.
Well, we're out together, bud.
See, I warned you last week that if you go together to try to game the system, it doesn't work. It has to be organic. All right.
That did happen.
That's right. I did it. I did it to go down in flames with my brother.
All right. Good
aww.
For you.
Oh, man. That's love.
Turn it into something noble. All right. That means that new flu vaccine practice guidelines increase precaution for patients with egg allergies due to an increase in reported allergic reactions is the fiction. Because the new guidelines are the exact opposite. They say do not worry at all about egg allergies with the flu vaccine. Basically, there are no reports of people with egg allergies having problems with the flu vaccine. The amount of egg, because flu vaccines are often incubated in eggs, but the amount of egg proteins that find their way into the final vaccine is negligible and it's too small to provoke an immune reaction. So even people who have a potentially fatal anaphylactic allergic reaction to eggs can still safely get the flu vaccine. So
that's cool.
Do not worry about your egg allergies. Get the flu vaccine. That's the bottom line. Those are the new recommendations.
I love
the exact
it.
But didn't they used to have to ask?
Yes, they still do.
On the form.
Oh, okay.
I had to check.
You don't
it.
Have to anymore. That's the thing. You don't have to ask. You don't have to avoid the flu vaccine. It's a non-issue. There's now enough evidence to say we can just get rid of this as a concern.
That makes me agnostic.
Nice.
No, I think these are excellent recommendations.
Oh, my God.
Yes. The evidence was extraordinary. All right. Evan, do you have a quote for us this week?
Wait, I'm not done cracking up yet at those wonderful jokes. All right. I do have a quote.
The yolk, it's, you got it, the yolk there?
And it's something I read earlier today, and it just stood out for me. I loved how it was phrased and was wryly stated. If you think something is breaking the laws of physics, then there is likely an error in perception. You know, which seems like just such an obvious sort of statement, but at the same time, when we were talking certainly about earlier in the show about the UFO story and how the people think that, you know, oh, new laws of physics are being broken because these things are moving in inconceivable ways. I mean, that's it. You have, like Bob said, you have to stop. That's it. Stop all everything. Go back to square one. You are so wrong. It's not even funny. There's such an infinitesimal chance that breaking the laws of physics is occurring in whatever you're observing. But it happens often, more often than we would like to see in the world of skeptical analysis. And Steve, that one is you. Steven Novella wrote that in his blog post about this.
It's very ass kissy.
No.
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, it was wry. I mean, was it meant to be wry?
Sure, always.
Oh, wait.
All right, guys. This is the end of our year. This is the last regular episode of the year.
Yeah, this was a hard year for a lot of reasons.
It was hard, but it was exciting and it was fun. And we're going to talk about all of it on next week's wrap-up episode, which we're recording live in 2 days from now, but that'll be yesterday when the show goes up. But you'll get to listen to it next week. And then we'll be back at the first of the year with our first episode of 2018. Those episodes are always fun too. We look at predictions and see how they did. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Doc.
Thank you.
Sure, it's our pleasure, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.